Hello and welcome to Studio Tulsa. For Rich Fisher, I'm Jason Heilman. My guest is conductor Timothy Brown. One of the leading British choral conductors of his generation, Brown began his musical career as a boy chorister at Westminster Abbey, where in 1958 he participated in the funeral service for composer Ralph Vaughan Williams. After singing in the choir of King's College at Cambridge under the direction of Sir David Wilcox, Brown became a music educator and choir director himself. In 1979, he succeeded composer John Rutter as director of the choir at Cambridge University's Clare College, where he went on to record several albums with the ensemble on the Naxos, Collegium, and Brilliant Classics labels. After stepping down from his position at Cambridge in 2010, he's been active as a freelance conductor worldwide, with regular appearances in Zurich and Jerusalem. He's here in Tulsa this weekend to conduct the choir at St. John's Episcopal Church in two performances of George Frideric Handel's Messiah, with an orchestra of 18th century period instruments. Those concerts will take place at the church this Saturday evening at 5 p.m. and Sunday afternoon at 3. Today, Tim is our guest on Studio Tulsa, and he'll be joined by St. John's organist and choir master Joseph Arendt later in the broadcast. Tim Brown, thank you for joining us today on Studio Tulsa.
Jason, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Before we discuss this weekend's performances, I'd like to talk about you and your career. How did you get your start in choral music?
Well, I came from a very musical family. My parents both sang. My grandfather was a professional singer. My grandmother, a professional pianist, and so on and so on. So I grew up with a lot of music in the family. My elder brother, 3 years ahead of me, was a chorister at Westminster Abbey and a pianist. And so I heard a lot of music going on as a child. And then I followed him, basically. I followed him as a chorister to Westminster Abbey and then as a music scholar to a very musical school. And then I took his place in the choir of King's College, Cambridge, under David Wilcox. Mm. So it was a continuous choral tradition from the age of about 8.
When you were a young boy, you sang in the funeral of Ralph Vaughan Williams?
That was my first gig.
Ah.
As a young chorister, you're a probationer for a year, and you basically just sit and listen. And then you get the full costume, and in you go with everybody else. And as I say, the first thing we did was to be summoned in the middle of the summer holidays to go and sing at the funeral service of Ralph Vaughan Williams, which was amazing.
And then you went on, as you said, to King's College, Cambridge.
Yes.
And that's another one of the great college choirs in London. Could you tell us a little bit about, in Cambridge, could
in
you
Cambridge.
Tell us about your experience?
Well, I mean, that's an amazing experience. I arrived, and I remember to this day, which is over 50 years ago now, I remember thinking after 10 minutes in the rehearsal, nobody in this choir ever makes mistakes. And I learned about concentration and discipline and preparation absolutely right off there. And it was a fantastic discipline.
And that was under Sir David Wilcox?
That was indeed under Sir David Wilcox.
But then you moved on into music education, is that correct?
Yes, so I was an alto lay clerk and I did my best and I had singing lessons. And at my last singing lesson, the teacher said to me, Brown, I wouldn't sing anymore. Well, thanks. Gee, thanks. So that with that ringing endorsement in my ear, I did actually carry on in a group, a sort of younger version of the King's Singers, for 3 years while I did teacher training. And then after 3 years, I gave it up and became a full-time music director.
So how long did you teach? And at what level did you teach?
So I taught in what we call a grammar school to begin with, which then became a mixed comprehensive school. And then I went to an independent boarding school called Oundle, where there was a very long, distinguished musical tradition. And I was there for 7 years before becoming director of music at Clare College, Cambridge, where I joined the university circus.
So how did you become the director at Clare College? How did that come about?
I applied for the job. I was already working in Cambridge as the conductor of the local symphony orchestra and chorus, so I knew about the advertisement, and I just chanced my arm and did an interview in front of David Wilcox. I had 23 and a half minutes to conduct the choir. I don't know about why it was the half minute. And in that time, I had to spot certain mistakes that the choir would make and generally impress them. And I apparently spotted all the mistakes.
And you had some famous shoes to fill at the time.
I had some famous shoes. John Rutter was my predecessor. He still lives in Cambridge, and we're great friends.
Coming from a primary and secondary school background, how did you approach this position?
A good question. I mean, essentially, I thought, well, now I've got to university, I won't have to have any issue with discipline or with motivation or any of those things. These are grown-ups. And little did I realize that these kids are away from home for the first time, many of them, and actually they needed a great deal of discipline and a great deal of organization. So that was a bit of a sharp learning curve. I thought I was going to be working with adults, and in fact, I might just as well have been back in the kindergarten with some of them. So actually getting the choir to be disciplined and bringing in my remembrances of my time in King's, I had, you know, 3 or 4 years of actually trying to get them to be really disciplined, because it was a voluntary choir until just before I got there. John Rutter was the person who started to bring in choral scholarships, but it was still basically a voluntary choir, and it transformed over the years, of course.
Well, I think it would be great to talk about the idea of a college choir at Cambridge, because our listeners here in Tulsa might be familiar with the idea of a university chorus at an American college, but college choirs in the UK are a little different. Could you maybe elaborate on how they function?
Well, certainly at Cambridge and Oxford, there are, well, I don't know what the number is now, but when I was back in the day, there were something like 25 colleges within the university. And each one of those colleges had, by university statute, had to have its own chapel. And most of them had their own choir. Mm. So when I was back in the early days at Cambridge, I mean, there were a number of extremely good competing college choirs singing in their chapel. But it was a religious event. It wasn't like a secular chorus. We sang liturgy 3 or 4 times a week. And for that, we had to learn the standard liturgical repertoire for the Episcopal Church. It was all Episcopal. And so, you know, Magnificats and Nunc Dimittis and anthems and so on. And the big challenge for me was that I had women in the choir, not trebles, not boy trebles like next door at King's College. Mm-hmm. And so to begin with, the girls thought that if they were going to be singing liturgical music in the style of the cathedral, they should try and make a sound like boys. And I really spent 4, 5, 6, 7 years trying to convince them that they were sopranos, they were not boys, and that they should sing like sopranos. So to begin with, if we did a broadcast, we very often got people writing in and saying, I love the sound of your boys, which really, really annoyed me. And it took quite a long time before I got letters saying, I really enjoy the sound of your women. But now, when I was in Clare Chapel the other day listening to my successor and his choir, there's no question. I mean, they sound like women, which is great.
So there is quite a tradition then of choir singing. And then you talked about going up in a system from a choir boy all the way up to through college. But was that revolutionary at the time to have women in your choir?
It was. We at Clare College was the first choir to take women in along with Trinity College down the road. And my colleague in Trinity, Richard Marlowe, he loved the sound of boy choristers, and he always insisted that his girls sounded like boy choristers with straight tone. Mm. I was different. I always wanted my girls to sing like women, and I wanted them to use their vibrato in a sensible and measured way, of course, but I wanted them to be free to sing as the female singer they were.
And you spent 30 years at Clare College.
It's amazing, but I spent 31.
31. And just stepping down in 2010, what are some highlights of your tenure there that you'd like to share?
Well, do you know, the real highlight was the daily office. I mean, it wasn't daily. We sang on Tuesday and Thursday and Sunday. But for me, going in on a Tuesday evening in the middle of the winter when there was very few people in the congregation and singing the liturgy to the best of our ability, that was, for me, my goal. If we had big services or we had great tours, or actually in my final year, we represented the university in a huge, great gala event in New York, which was immensely exciting. And the choir sang on a big stage, and that was thrilling. And we did some wonderful tours. I mean, from 86, I brought the choir to America every 3 years, and we had wonderful tours all over the place. And so those were exciting, but it was the daily liturgy. It was singing psalms. Absolutely love singing psalms. I think the psalms are a wonderful book of poetry, and the Anglican chants that accompany them are fine, and that's, for me, the best.
Now, you stepped down in 2010, but you didn't retire. Where has your career taken you?
Musicians
since then?
Don't retire. So I stepped down in 2010. I was 63, and the university demands that you step down at 67. And I thought, well, at 67, nobody will employ me. Maybe at 63, I might just get some employment. And so actually I started to I founded a professional choir in Zurich in Switzerland, a choir that was associated with the Tonhaller Orchestra. And that was very exciting because we were working with wonderful maestros like Bernard Haitink and Charles Dutoit, and lots of other world-famous conductors came in, and I prepared them with a Rohr Requiem or the B minor Mass or something else. And I actually got to conduct the Tonhaller Orchestra as well with my choir. That was very exciting, and I did that for 5 years. And then that came to an end, and I came back to England. And since then, I enjoyed occasional gigs, like coming to Tulsa, which is fantastic. And this is the third year I've come to St. John's.
Now, coming from an academic career, and we talked about having to motivate the students a little bit ago, what was it like conducting professionals in Zurich? How is it different,
I mean, it's very interesting. I love conducting amateur choirs. Yesterday, I went out to Owasso to conduct one of the school choirs there. And I didn't know them. They didn't know me. We'd never met before. And I had them for an hour. And it was just sheer delight. We had a great deal of fun. And it's a challenge to see what you can get out of young people and how you can tap into their enthusiasm and so on. When you're working with professional singers, too often you're working with people who, frankly, are more interested in the paycheck than the music in front of them. And so actually, if I was honest, I would say the best musical experience I've had in my life have been working with amateur singers. I mean, I have a professional group in London called English Voices, and last year we did a performance of Bach's B minor Mass with just 10 singers and a wonderful Baroque orchestra, and that was a wonderful highlight. They were hand-picked singers, and I picked them because I knew that they were enthusiastic, and you know, they had the enthusiasm of the amateur and the professional technique of the professional. But that was special. And too often, it's just kind of a job.
You also conduct in Israel now, I understand. Is that?
Yeah, I've been going backs and forwards to Israel for many years. There's a fantastically good chamber orchestra called the Israel Camerata, which was founded 30 years ago, mostly from Russian immigrants who came with their training at the Moscow Conservatoire and big fat vibratos and goodness knows what. And I've seen them change over 30 years. And I was there 3 weeks ago. We were doing a fantastic piece by Zelenka, the Requiem. And I was preparing the chorus, so I was not actually conducting the concert. So I was sitting in the audience watching these players. And it was miraculous to see how over the years they've learnt how to be Baroque. And they were all playing with a wonderfully controlled vibrato and making this fantastic sound. So it's lovely to go and work with them. And they are fully professional, and yet they have the enthusiasm of the amateur. I mean, they're just fantastic to work with. And I'm going back there next summer to conduct some Bach cantatas conduct the orchestra. And I'm looking forward to that. I mean, Israel is an interesting place and contentious for many people. And I've had all sorts of problems, people writing to me and saying, don't go to Israel, otherwise we'll be on your back. And I took a choir there, actually, and we gave a pre-tour concert in Cambridge. And we had protests outside the door from the people who support Palestine. And I'm fully in support of Palestine, but I'm also equally fully in support of the Israelis to do their own thing. And so it's been interesting. But I love going there, and I have a big contact with a kibbutz, where a former student of mine has started a very big music program, and I go there and work with his choirs, and great fun. In fact, 3 weeks ago, he took me to Haifa, where I conducted one of his choirs that he founded 3 or 4 years ago, and I remember conducting them 2 years ago, and they were dreadful. And this time, they were fantastic. And the average age of this choir, there are about 30 of them, and the average age is about 86. The average age is about 86. So there are people well into their 90s singing in this choir, and they're fantastic. So that, for me, that's terrific. I love that kind of adventure.
Well, you've made several recordings over the years. Let's take a moment and hear one of your recordings.
Thank you.
That was an excerpt from O Nata Lux by Thomas Tallis, with the choir of Clare College, Cambridge, led by Timothy Brown. Timothy Brown is our guest today here on Studio Tulsa, just ahead of his performances of Handel's Messiah with the choir of St. John's Episcopal Church. I'm Jason Heilman, in for Rich Fisher, and we're also joined today by Joseph Arendt, the choir master and organist at St. John's. Trained at Westminster Choir College and Juilliard, Joseph has been leading the choir at St. John's for 3.5 years now, and this performance of Handel's Messiah that's taking place this weekend is now in its second year. How did this come about?
Well, I moved here from the New York area, and the New York area is rather inundated with Messiah performances. And so one of the things I noticed when I moved to Tulsa was that there are a few that go on every year, but otherwise I thought that there was a lot of room to have what for the local community could be a really fresh interpretation of it. So in the New York area, for example, there are a number of opportunities to hear Messiah in what you'd call a historical style or Baroque style, where you use a smaller number of instruments and a smaller number of people in the choir. I use Baroque pitch, where everything sounds half a step down, a lighter approach to it, just lightness to most things, and plus with historical instruments or replicas of instruments that were very similar to what Handel knew. And so I love Messiah. I know if you're a professional musician, you can play many, many, many Messiahs in your life over your career. But to me, I just always think there's so much freshness with it. And I think that when you perform it with the forces and the style in which we're doing it, I think the real essence of the music comes out. You know, I think it's easy for Messiah to come across as you would perform it in the same style you'd perform other instruments. You know, it's heavy, lots of vibrato, it's a bit on the slow side, but, you know, Baroque music actually is at its best, in my opinion, when you sort of have, in some ways, an opposite approach. You know, it's always related to dance music, and vibrato is there, but as Tim mentioned earlier, it's controlled. You know, that there are times in the texture where you really want these harmonies to just almost, I describe it as light, like it's just this pure sound, and the lack of vibrato just brings a real clarity to the music that I think when people aren't as careful, perhaps, or as attentive to how they use their vibrato, it can cause the musical lines to not be as clear. You know, the Messiah has so many different tunes going on at the same time, and I think the audience really needs to hear all that Handel did to interpret the text.
Well, Tim, how did you become involved with a Messiah performance in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of all places?
Some 11 years ago, I was doing a sabbatical year at Westminster Choir College from Cambridge, and I got to know Joseph well. And then when he graduated and he moved to Grace Church in Newark, he kindly invited me to bring Clare College Choir to sing, and then I came back on my own and did a work with the choir. And so we became good friends, and when he moved here, he suggested I might like to come and work with the choir. So 3 years ago I came and we did a program, I think, of Vivaldi and Handel. And then last year we thought we'd tackle Messiah with a Baroque orchestra. Mm-hmm. And this was very striking, I think, to the congregation, because they were not used to hearing, as Joseph described earlier, this kind of light approach. And it went so well that we decided this year to repeat it and to extend it, so we're doing most of the Messiah this year.
Well, let's talk about the piece itself, if you don't mind. It's George Frideric Handel's most famous work, but it actually represents something of a career departure for him at the time, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I'm not an expert on Handel's life, but he had a fantastic career as an opera composer, mm-hmm. and for various reasons that became less successful. And he had a long association with the librettist Jennings, and they devised this project of Messiah, and I think it's just one of those things. It worked, and it has always worked ever since, partly because the text tells this story. I mean, it's not an opera, but it has the dramatic strength of an operatic libretto. And I think if you have a performance where each movement leads smoothly into the next, and you go from the solos into the chorus and so on, then I think it works really dramatically, and the audience is drawn along with you the whole way.
So even though, I mean, it's Handel making his shift from an opera composer into something of a sacred composer, he still brings his operatic background with him in a way.
He certainly does. And when we get to the part two choruses, which tell the story of Christ's crucifixion and his scourging and so on, I mean, there's no lack of drama in that at all. And we're very excited to be adding those choruses this time round.
And one thing that I think is worth mentioning is that often people will go to a performance billed as Handel's Messiah, and often what you hear is only a small bit of it. It's common to, at least around this time of year, to have a Handel's Messiah performance consist of some bits of part one, maybe one or two things from part two, and they skip to the Hallelujah chorus, and often that's it. So I think it's wonderful to hear part one and the Hallelujah chorus in Advent and Christmas, but for me, there's so much that can be lost by only experiencing those excerpts. And I think that it's a very powerful experience to hear from the beginning to the end. You know, you start with words from Isaiah, "Comfort ye my people." Then you get the passages about Christ's birth, but and then his life, his crucifixion, as Tim said, and his resurrection, but also the spreading of the early church. And you have passages from Romans, et cetera, about the early church forming. And then, you know, it ends with texts from Revelation and some things in between. But it's a very powerful experience. And at least for people who observe Christmas in a sort of more deliberate Christian way, you know, it's making that connection that we have Easter because we had Christmas. And Christmas means what it does because it led to Easter. You know, and the way, as Tim said, he composed opera, Handel composed opera, but there still is a lot of, you can tell he was an operatic composer because the most memorable and compelling parts are, for me, in part two and part three, where the music just reinforces the words. You know, I often remember very important words because of the music that I learned it with. And I think that's how a lot of us are. Music, when it really works, when it's paired with the text in a really effective way, it teaches you something. You
know, we cannot escape the fact that Handel was devout. And for me, as I was explaining to one of the soloists this morning, when they stand up and sing, when she stands up and sings, "I know my Redeemer liveth," she's preaching. It's a sermon. It's a sermon through music. And that's a crucial element in the performance. If the audience has to be engaged by the storyteller at the beginning and taken through the aspects of Christ's biography, his actual biographical life, birth and his living and his death and his resurrection. But also, as Joseph says, it talks about what happens in the church and the spreading the word throughout the region and so on. All those elements, it's really important that there's no dip in this consecutive story. And that's why the Hallelujah chorus is so much better if it comes as part of part two and not just as an add-on to the birth. And certainly, "Worthy is the Lamb" and the Amen chorus, that has a conclusivity to it, which doesn't work unless you've had part two and part three before it.
You've been talking about period instruments and historical style. What is the root of that? What do we mean by period instruments?
Well, they were much lighter in construction, just like the piano. You know, we know a modern piano with its steel frame. All that depended on technology. And in the 18th century, we didn't have that technology. And so wind instruments, trumpets, even string instruments were rather different to what they are now. In we're used to a symphony orchestra, for instance, playing with steel strings. Well, of course, a steel string on a violin that can take it is going to make a very powerful sound. Baroque instruments use gut strings, like cow gut, I think it is. And sometimes they wind that with some wire, but generally speaking, they will use just gut strings. That's a much, much lighter sound. They also use bows, which are a different shape to a modern bow, and that produces a different sound. And one thing that's very noticeable compared with a modern orchestra is that a Baroque orchestra blends much more carefully. It's not so, the trumpets and the oboes don't stick out in the way they stick out in a modern orchestra. So this all encourages you to create a kind of chamber music feel. and Joseph referred to earlier to the dance quality of Baroque music. So there's a kind of intimacy to it. And it's interesting to me because my entire professional career has lined up exactly with the beginning of the Baroque movement. So when I first started professional music making, that was the very early days of Baroque authentic instrument orchestras. And they were terrible. I mean, the instruments were terrible. They couldn't play in tune. The violins sounded really like they were on their last death throes. And, I mean, for a time, there were people who said, why would I want to listen to a Baroque orchestra? It's just terrible. And so I'd much rather have Messiah done with a symphony orchestra and a chorus of 250. Gradually, as the instruments have become better and the technical ability of the players has got better, it's been possible to create a really special sound, which allows you to perform with very few singers. So people might think that our choir, which is something like 20, 23 singers, is much too small. No, it's not, because it enables the clarity of the music to really shine through. And when it's performed with care, you can still create a dramatic span. It's not all going to sound terribly small and little, but it's going to be on a scale that some people will find new. In a way, you have to buy into it. If you buy into it, you'll suddenly find it's got a whole new interpretation of a piece that you thought you knew.
Well, Joseph and Tim, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Very much a pleasure.
Conductor Timothy Brown and organist Joseph Arndt speaking with us today on Studio Tulsa. Tim will be conducting two performances of George Frideric Handel's Messiah with an orchestra of 18th century period instruments this Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon at St. John's Episcopal Church here in Tulsa, where Joseph serves as organist and choirmaster. For more information on these performances, call 918-742-7381. If you'd like to hear more of Timothy and Joseph's discussion of Handel's Messiah, along with some extended musical excerpts, tune into my show, Classical Tulsa, this Friday at noon on our sister station, Classical 88.7. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. For Rich Fisher, I'm Jason Heilman. Thanks for listening to Public Radio Tulsa.